My name is Cheryl A. Stryker, and I'm just going to explain real quick what we're going to do here. We have 1 hour session, so we're keeping this very informal. We're each just going to talk for a few minutes, and we want to leave it open a lot for questions for any of you to ask about our project and projects or collaboration. So I'm Cheryl A. Stryker. I currently work at the Auburn Avenue Research Library in African American Culture and History, a special library of the Atlanta Fulton Public Library System. Very long title. A little bit about me. I got my MLIS degree from College of St. Catherine / Dominican University. I have a Master's in Philosophy of Modern History and Literature from Drew University, and I'm currently working on my PhD at Drew University. I have worked as a John Foster and Janet Avery Dulles Fellow at Princeton, and also worked at the archives at Drew University, and I most recently completed a project at University of Chicago. And then now I'm here at Auburn Avenue working on this collaborative. And to introduce the rest of our panelists here, Courtney Chartier, right here, is currently the Voter Education Project Archivist and Assistant Head of Archives, the Archives Research Center at the Atlanta University Center Woodruff Library, and formerly the archivist for the Morehouse College Martin Luther King Jr. Collection. Sarah Quigley has a BA in History and in 2003 from University of Texas Austin, an MSIS at University of Texas Austin in 2007, and previously worked at the Jesse Helms Center processing his congressional papers. And Christopher Harder is the director of the Library and Reference Services at the Amistad Research Center in New Orleans. He received his MLS from Indiana University and has worked at the Indiana Historical Society, Indiana University, and the University of Illinois. Now, just a brief description of what our project is and how we came to be a collaboration. We each applied for grants through CLEAR, through the Council of Library and Information Resources. There's actually three grants, one from the Amistad Research Center, one from the Atlanta University Center, and then a joint one between Emory University and the Auburn Avenue Research Library. And then we all applied separately wanting to process hidden civil rights collections, and CLEAR came back and said, hey, guess what? We'll give you money if you all do it together. And we said, okay. So essentially, that's how it came to be. But and we're very excited to be working together and sharing resources and ideas. However, even though we are collaborating, we each administer our grants separately, like budget reporting and things like that. But we do discuss things very often, which we will go through and explain individually. And so just a couple other things. If you saw, we have a poster outside. That is something that we did. CLEAR brought all their grant recipients together, and we all did poster sections explaining our project. So if you have a minute, take a look. And if you're interested in the other CLEAR projects, they're all on the CLEAR website in their hidden collection section. So first off, Courtney is going to talk about some of the challenges that we've had. Sarah will then talk about some of the opportunities, and Chris will talk about some of the other aspects of our collaboration.
Good morning. Really the biggest challenge we face is the geographical distance. Since we all wrote different grants that were then bundled together, we all applied for different kinds of funding, so there's not necessarily travel funds for the four of us to come together and meet. Our grant staff is actually much larger. Our principal investigators, none of us are except for Chris, are the principal investigators on our grant, so there's actually several grant members. Then traveling is almost impossible. Because even though we're three different grants based together on subject, the bundling was not our decision, so we all have very, very different needs and different projects, specifically different processing needs. Two of the grants are using MPLP standards, two of the grants aren't. We have different technology needs. One of us is using Archivist Toolkit as a part of a pilot program. One is using Archon as part of a pilot program. And we have very different start times based on staffing. For instance, even though we all got our grants at the same time, Woodruff Library staffed fully with professional staff pretty much before all the other libraries, so our processing started much earlier. That way all four of us are at different stages in our grants at all different times. In our first meeting, we tried to discuss as many possible approaches to collaboration as we could. We even did things, talked about things that we knew would probably be outside of our reach just to get as many ideas going. But one thing that we didn't do was ever set shared guidelines for approaches, techniques, or reporting other than doing regular discussion and updates through conference call or meetings in Atlanta with Amistad calling in. Some of our ideas have worked over the past year and a half, and some of them haven't. We do have some ideas that we hope to implement going forward, but I won't talk about the things that we have worked on that have worked out because Sarah's going to cover that. But one thing that we did discuss that we would love to do and is just outside of our reach is a traveling exhibition. And I think financially that may be prohibitive, but it's an idea that we came up with initially that we could all combine documents from our kind of hidden civil rights collections, travel around the South and to our various institutions. One idea that we still kind of hope to implement is to create a civil rights archives wiki that would specifically be a user-guided wiki for institutions with archival civil rights-related collections, just as another way of exposing hidden civil rights collections throughout the country. We do have somewhat of a retrospective wish list for things we could have done, including writing shared guidelines for MPLP so we'd be able to compare our processes and how it worked out, and a rubric for technology comparison. And that way, when as one of us implemented AT and one of us implemented Archon, we could have had a standard for comparing those experiences.
I'm just going to stay seated. Can everyone hear me? Okay, that's much better. I want to keep my remarks brief so that we have plenty of time for you all in the audience to ask us lots of great questions. Though we have had some challenges based on our geographical distance, we've also found a number of ways to bridge that gap, one of which is our commitment to using Web 2.0 technology as a collaborative tool and a promotional tool. The Emory Auburn Avenue First Layer Collaborative has constructed a Facebook page for our two projects alone. It doesn't involve Atlanta University Center or Amistad. And we've had a lot of great response to our Facebook presence. We use our page to post updates on our project's progress and also other civil rights related events in Atlanta or links to other civil rights archival collections or online exhibits. As of early last week when I was making my notes, I think we had just under 400 fans, including the son of a former president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which is the collection that I'm working on, as well as a member of the Georgia State Legislature and a DeKalb County judge. So we are getting noticed, and we're very excited about that. We have tried to use the discussions tab in the Facebook to generate a little bit more excitement, and unfortunately we haven't had quite as much success with that, but we're hoping going forward we'll be able to hit upon the exact strategy to get people excited about talking about civil rights archives. We also have a collaborative blog that does involve all four of the grant projects. And we each post once a month, alternating weeks, so that we have one post made each week around Friday so that we're staying regular. Excuse me. We've tried to orient the blog so that it reaches out both to potential researchers as well as to professionals in the archival community, with posts about the practices and methods that we're using to process our various collections. We have had posts about Amistad's use of Archon, Atlanta University Center's use of Archivist Toolkit, and also Amistad's student intern program. It also has been an excellent way for our students to get involved. Amistad especially has had a really good participation rate among its graduate and undergraduate student employees, and they write incredible posts about their experience working with archival collections, some of whom have never worked with archival materials before. The blog itself is a little bit interesting in that it's actually part of the Emory Library's blog. This has caused a little bit of confusion with people thinking that all four of the collaboratives are all four of the collaborative project archivists and all four of our collections are actually part of Emory's archives. We've tried to mitigate this a little bit with a descriptive paragraph about the grant project at the beginning of each entry. And this has helped. Ultimately, though, we feel that having our blog be part of the overall Emory Libraries blog will be more beneficial than not. The hope is that that will enable us to have a stable long-term home for the blog after the grant ends in 2012. It also has made it easy to use some Google Analytics to figure out what kind of readership we're having, though we're early in looking at any of that kind of information. For our own project management across the four institutions, we've also used a Google group, and that has allowed us to share documents and have a centralized location for a lot of our management and planning documents. Another element of the grant in terms of our collaboration will be some innovative linking to related collections in our finding aids, because all of us are not done yet. We're not to this point, but we're really looking forward to some of the possibilities between our various institutions. For example, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference records finding aid at Emory could link to the Andrew Young papers finding aid at Auburn Avenue, which could also link to the Daisy Young papers finding aid at Amistad, who Daisy Young was Andrew Young's mother. Finally, we have been able to share information about the technologies such as Archivist Toolkit and Archon, and also discuss the ways that we use student help in processing our collections, as well as our various project management techniques. Emory especially has been really eager to share with the other collaborative members our project management documentation, specifically our work plan template, which Cheryl is using at Auburn Avenue. Cheryl is also using our team processing methods with her students' processing series and having a high degree of responsibility for the work that's done on the collections. And finally, Chris has shared with us their student internship program and some of their methods for involving student work in the processing of their collections.
Well, good morning, everyone. Briefly, what I want to touch upon is this idea that these individual projects came together under the rubric of a shared theme in the collections that we were processing, and how some of those connections between the collections have brought together some collaboration, as well as touch a little bit on this idea of hidden collections and how we've utilized that. In the archival world, when we talk about exposing hidden collections, I think oftentimes the emphasis is put on what can this do for the researchers, which, of course, is as it should be. But I think this collaboration has also brought about the beginning to think about the idea of hidden collections are not only hidden from researchers, but they're hidden from the institutions that house them, and what opportunities can be gained from exposing these collections. Certainly, as collections are processed and made available under a project such as this, that gives us an opportunity to communicate and collaborate with our researchers and with our users. But also it gives us a chance to look at collaboration among institutions, and I think this coming together of these four institutions has been a great example of that. If we also take a look at hidden collections as an opportunity for donor relations, I know that's something that we focused on with our hidden collections grant at Amistad, reaching out to donors and providing them information on, say, a collection that may have been there for 10, 20 years, unfortunately, and now being able to bring that collection to light. And it also provides an opportunity for revenue. As collections are exposed, they're processed, institutions learn about what they have. That gives an opportunity for, duplication, use in publications and productions and such. I was actually joking with one of my colleagues a couple weeks ago that I'm beginning to take a biblical look at hidden collections. And I think this has been a good example that hidden collections beget hidden collections beget hidden collections. At Amistad, for our specific grant, we kind of purposely at the beginning put a double twist on the idea of hidden collections. And what we did was to take nine collections of personal papers of individuals who were officers in state and local civil rights organizations, specifically because those individuals' papers also included records for those state and local organizations. If you take a look at a national organization, they're more likely to have their records centralized in one place. More localized organizations, those records tend to follow the president or the secretary as they go off. And that is something that we had found researchers requesting, wanting those local and state chapter records that we were often finding hidden in an individual's papers. And so that was kind of the genesis of Amistad's grant and kind of that double twist on the hidden collections. But as fellow panelists have found, in processing these grants, they've been able to kind of draw out some of those additional hidden collections. At Auburn Avenue, with the processing of the Andrew Young papers, they also found a substantial portion of records that dealt with his first wife, Jean Childs Young. Those have now been processed as a separate collection. And at Emory, SCLC Foundation records have come out of the larger SCLC records. And so once we've kind of delved into these collections, we found that additional material that was even hidden from us as the institutions that house those. At Amistad, apart from the civil rights collections, our CLEAR project allowed us to implement some policies and some software not only specific to these nine collections, but our collections as a whole. And as part of that, in processing some additional collections, we've been able to find things such as a Man Ray photograph in the County Cullen papers, a 19th century Vai manuscript, which is a West African language that we now know is only the fifth recorded copy in a U.S. library. So we've been able to draw out a lot of really interesting materials that we had no idea were at the institutions. From an institutional standpoint, again, taking a look at this idea of collaboration and what hidden collections and exposing hidden collections can do, it's already been mentioned the connection between the Daisy Young papers at the Amistad Research Center and the Andrew Young papers as well. And being able to use this idea of linking the finding aids. We finished the Daisy Young papers, and so we now have a link to a mention of the Andrew Young papers, and we'll expand that once those collections or that collection is open for research. So it gives us an opportunity not only for the institutions but for researchers to be able to provide a trail of additional resources. If they look at one finding aid, it'll link to others and create this web of information. Thematic connections between the institutions and the collections have also aided us in the processing. In the Daisy Young papers, I came across a publication called CEP News, which was published by the Citizenship Education Program at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in cooperation with the American Missionary Association. This particularly struck me because the American Missionary Association is the founding organization for the Amistad Research Center. And so it was nice to be able to see that connection, these two groups working together back in 1966 on this publication. However, when I was trying to learn a little bit more about this, there were no holdings for this publication recorded in OCLC, but I was able to go to some of the fellow panelists to get some more information. Is there anything in the SCLC records on this publication? There may be some additional material in the King papers, Atlanta as well. So that has been an example of how we've been able to aid each other in the processing of the collections as we've gone along. And certainly this is going to bring about the potential for collaboration and connection with institutions outside of this collaboration. The NAACP records at Library of Congress, material at the King Center as well. And as we proceed with this collaboration and these projects, those opportunities for further collaboration are going to open up as we go along. And getting back to the aid to researchers for exposing hidden collections, as these types of materials become available and more well-known, this is going to open up opportunities for new scholarly directions, materials that had not been available to researchers in the past. As we continue to make these available, there's going to be new sources for scholarship that can open up new avenues for topics. Looking at even a topic such as the civil rights movement, various groups, individuals like Andrew Young, there may be aspects that haven't been known before, but by providing these primary sources, we're providing more information to the researchers and more potential. And advertising these collections as a group through some of the social networking, such as the blog, linking of the finding aids, and also conferences such as SAA, reaching out not only to colleagues in the archival world, but also last February, Amistad participated in a scholarly conference in Jackson, Mississippi, and we've been discussing examples to further that as our collections and collaboration comes along to be able to reach out to more and more researchers at a particular subject or scholarly conferences as well. So as we continue on, we will have more updates on the blog and such, and keep everyone up to date on what's going on. So.
What we're going to talk about next, just briefly, is also what our future plans are now that we've sort of talked about what we've done. And also, we've mentioned a lot of collections in here, so we can each go through and say which collections each institution is actually working on, just to clarify. So for me at Auburn Avenue, I have the Andrew Young papers, former right-hand person to assistant to Dr. King, as well as congressman, ambassador, mayor, and a plethora of other things. And I'm also doing the NAACP Atlanta branch records. So that'll show some of those connections that we have. And as I continue, well, we're all going to talk about the things that we're going to do besides actually finish processing our collections, which is the first thing. But I plan on creating some MPLP guidelines for Auburn Avenue Research Library. I'm the first one to actually do any MPLP at the institution. And so I can create some guidelines. We've had discussions about public programming, not just in Atlanta, but, you know, with all of us as well,
possibly a symposium, bringing in scholars, discussing our collections after, of course, they're open for research. I've also so far written a few articles for the New Georgia Encyclopedia. They're not published yet. They're still being fact-checked and everything, but I was inspired to write four from topics that I found while processing the collections, as well as a biography about Jean Childs Young, who was not represented yet. And I also wrote an encyclopedia entry for her for a new women's encyclopedia that's coming out. So we're not just focusing on Georgia, trying to get everything out in the broader scholarly community.
Right. The collection we're processing at AUC is the Organizational Records of the Voter Education Project. It was an Atlanta-based civil rights organization that grew out of the Southern Regional Council. So initially it was a government body, but in the late 60s broke off and was in Atlanta up through the early 90s. VEP's mission was basically they just gave away money. Organizations would apply for a grant from VEP, and VEP would fund either their voter education or voter registration projects as long as they were nonpartisan. And in the kind of classic civil rights movement, VEP supported organizations like SNCC. The very first grant was to SNCC in Montgomery. They also supported the activities of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in Sunflower County. Fannie Lou Hamer wrote all the grant documents that we have from that group. So there are a lot of major civil rights figures represented in the papers. John Lewis was one of their executive directors. SCLC under Dr. King was a grantee. In the 70s, VEP really, and this is where our hidden collection within a hidden collection comes in, is VEP really moved to supporting other types of civil rights movements, including women's groups, but also Chicano rights groups all around the Texas border and South Texas area. John Lewis, really, as executive director, changed their mission to focus on human rights, broadly human rights, rather than just the African American rights movement. So one thing we plan to do, CLEAR does not support any digitization within its grants, but we have a strong in-house digitization program at AUC, as well as a strong focus on digital exhibition. So we do plan to move forward with a digital exhibition that reflects the history of the Voter Education Project in Atlanta. That's just at our own cost, but it is in our own interest to exposing the papers.
As I mentioned earlier, I'm processing the Southern Christian Leadership Conference records at Emory, and it is when we accessioned the collection, it was approximately 1,200 linear feet, and we have 3 years to process all 1,200 boxes. We're making really great progress. We are on schedule. At the end of our first year, we were about a third of the way through. We were hoping to use some more traditional MPLP techniques. Unfortunately, the collection was more disorganized than we thought, so we are having to take a little bit more granular approach to just identifying the records that we have. But we have some really wonderful materials in this collection. We basically have the organizational records beginning in April of 1968, following the assassination of Dr. King. We have fairly comprehensive documentation of the two presidents following King, Ralph David Abernathy and Joseph Lowery, both of whom were incredibly active nationally in the civil rights movement, but in Atlanta as well. We have quite a bit of material from the Citizenship Education Project. And we also have sort of unexpectedly discovered quite a bit from Martin Luther King Speaks radio program that began in 1967 and ran through the 1970s. When it began, it was to broadcast his speeches, but after he died, it became more about his legacy. And we have quite a bit of audio of people like Andrew Young and Joseph Lowery talking about their experiences in the movement and how they envisioned the movement going forward. But we also have women like Florence Kennedy and Diane Schulder who are on the radio talking about women's reproductive rights. And a lot of topics that you wouldn't necessarily expect to find on a radio program called Martin Luther King Speaks.
Well, as I'd mentioned, rather than working on just one or two rather large collections, Amistad is working on nine smaller collections of personal papers. And just to give you an example of some of those, an addendum to the records of New Orleans Creole lawyer A.P. Turo features material on Louisiana and New Orleans chapters of the NAACP in which he was active. The Rose Carver Fishman letters are a series of 18 letters that were written to her by Fannie Lou Hamer, very personal, very touching letters, talking about not only organizational activities, but her personal life and family as well. The Ronnie Moore papers, who was active in the Congress of Racial Equality in the Bogalusa area of Louisiana, as well as James Eckert Allen, who was president of the New York City branch of the NAACP. And in a way, I probably shouldn't mention this, but Allen gives us an example of hidden collections that don't quite turn out to be what we'd hoped they had been. The accession record for this collection, which the center had had for many years, and it's one of those collections that looked like when it was received, it was literally just dumped in boxes, and so it was hard to appraise it. But based on the accession record and looking in some of the boxes, we thought, okay, there's a sizable chunk of New York NAACP material in here. Well, come to find out, a lot of that NAACP material was duplicates of just the same material over and over again. So that was actually an example of there wasn't quite what we thought there was going to be or hoped for, but still it was processed and is now available. Much like Courtney had said, one of the things that we're going to be looking beyond the purview of the CLEAR grant is digitization of some of this material. As we've learned more and more what's in these collections, we're really finding a lot of exciting gems that we're going to be looking to work with the Louisiana Digital Library, the Civil Rights Digital Library, to get more of this information digitized and available as well.
Stand up again. So we've all talked about our collaboration. You've heard a little bit about our collections. We've all very much enjoyed working together to discover new things, new collections, new ways of collaborative. We've had challenges. We've had opportunities. But overall, I think we've all found this to be a really great experience. And part of our purpose of the session today is to share mostly about our collaboration. And but we are happy to talk about our specific collections as well. I'm sorry we didn't have enough handouts, but for those of you who didn't get it, it's a very small, hard-to-read version of our poster that's outside, and it is available online on the CLEAR website. So anyway, we wanted to thank CLEAR, thank all of you for coming, and if anyone has any questions, please ask them now. Anybody? Yes. Sure. I will be, as you all know, sessions are being recorded, so I'll repeat the question. It was about, we mentioned linking our finding aids for the collections that are connected and how we're going to go about doing that and to what level. And I think right now, like one of the biggest ones we have, Andy and SCLC, Andy and Daisy, and there will be other connections as well. I don't think we know what all of them are yet, but at least a reference to what specific collection and what institution it is. Until we have actual links to finding aids and stuff, I'm not sure to what level we're going to do that. If anyone else wants to...
Yeah, in Archon, which we're using at Amistad, there's a related materials field in which you can include the link directly to websites, finding aids, and such outside of the institution, and that's what we're doing at Amistad. So...
In the front here? All right. To repeat the comment about that is that... that's okay. Because we are a collaborative and we have a lot of connections, some of which we know and some of which we haven't found yet, using new resources to show those beyond the finding aids. Is that it in a nutshell? And like, yeah, and it like NEH giving digitization grants for whole collections instead of just pieces as and using resources like that to try to branch out and explore these new ways to show our collaboration and connections between collections. But
I think the key might be that the library term federated search.
Right.
We might be able to do that.
Well, this is kind of the concept behind the idea for the Civil Rights Archives Wiki, which would not be a place to aggregate information on a civil rights figure or an organization, but a place to aggregate information on the collections available about that figure. And I'm, most of you are probably aware of the Civil Rights Digital Library, which UGA hosts as part of their Digital Library of Georgia. The idea behind the wiki would be slightly different in the sense that it wouldn't be links out to institutions. It would be a place to actually have like an article on Andrew Young, and it would include that there's materials at the SCLC organizational records and at Amistad Research Center about his mother, and maybe even, you know, just wherever he appears. The problem with that idea is that we were looking at it as the four of us would be a pilot and then open the invitation up to the community once we had established guidelines, up to the archival community, and invite institutions that we knew had large civil rights collections to contribute. And that's where things fall apart, is that you can send out, and we'll hopefully this is something we're going to implement, is that you send out the invitations and you have to get the buy-in. But the idea would be that it would just be to aggregate collection information so that you could look at the one page for Martin Luther King Jr. and see all these kind of disparate pieces that are all over the country.
Dan?
I'd like to hear from the panel about what they thought were the strengths and weaknesses of Web 2.0 technology you used through this project.
Okay. The question was talking about the strengths and weaknesses of utilizing Web 2.0 throughout the project. Anyone want to start?
I'll talk a little bit about that. When we were first doing research to decide which blogging platform we were going to use, we had a lot of concerns about how we would be able to set up administrative access for four different institutions and how we would be able to preserve the document going forward. If we had used WordPress or Blogger, for example, where would that live 3 years from now when no one was updating it anymore and everyone had forgotten about this project? And luckily, the Emory Libraries blog sort of fell into our lap at just the right time. However, that actually complicated the administrative access portion because I am the only one who can post to that blog. So everyone has to email me their entries, and then I edit the photos, and I do the HTML to get the layout just right, and I post it, which doesn't honestly take a lot of time to do. However, I think we all agree that if we had a platform where we all could just log in and submit, that we could do it very quickly, and that would not be quite so onerous on one of us. However, it's worked out okay for what the Emory's Library blog can do for us. We're quite pleased with this setup.
I would like to, on behalf of the panel, actually publicly thank Sarah for taking on that role. She's been very good at gently nudging us. Hey, that blog entry's due. Can you get it to us by the end of the day? And such. So.
Well, and with Sarah and I having our Facebook page too, what we've really tried to do is not just focus on our collections, but try to educate any of our fans about other resources that we know about and make it a little bit broader than beyond Emory and Auburn Avenue's and Atlanta's walls.
And as far as challenges goes, speaking about the wiki, picking a platform is actually the hardest part. But speaking about the blog, initially when we had Sarah brought the idea of using the Emory's blog, I was very happy about it, and I still am, and don't want to badmouth Emory in any way. But there, I had never considered that I would have to be going through the administration of an institution that was not my own. And there's been one point where there was material I deemed appropriate for the blog that higher up than Sarah was deemed inappropriate.
You can be more specific about
that. I had a flyer from a civil rights organization in Alabama that had some language on it that was determined inappropriate for the Emory blog.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be clear, there was some concern about how our readership would feel about that language and what we ended up doing. I mean, the entry is there and the photo is there, but what we had done was just a little bit of creative thumbnail creation so that we focused in on a very small portion of the image that did not include the concerning language, and then you can click on it and see the entire photo. It's not edited in any way. We were all quite happy to put it up. It was just that other members of the blog committee were a little worried that we would get some heat if we just put it out there with no preparation. So there were some discussions that happened.
It's a challenge when you have four different institutions, even though Emory and Auburn are on the same grant, that we all have different administrations and probably approach things differently in that respect.
I'm not sure who was first. I know someone in the back had had a question for a while, or in the black. Sure. The question was about utilizing graduate students processing largely unorganized collections and large collections and utilizing subject expertise in the processing. And I know both Sarah and I use students from Emory who are graduate students in history, and both of my students are focusing and writing about the civil rights movement, and my one student who has done an amazing job processing the, I estimate, 30,000 photographs in the Andrew Young collection has done a great job of identifying a lot of people on as we all know, mostly unlabeled photographs, typical of collections, and not just people, but places and other countries. As Andrew traveled across the globe, she was able to recognize Jamaica through some of her studies and other countries to be able to identify at least where something possibly happened. And I know for me, my other student is focusing on post-68, which is what also a lot of Andrew's material is, and I talked to him about the content and there's a lot of stuff that it's not that I can't always identify, but ensuring that I can make it available in the best, easiest, most accessible possible way. And so him knowing he's going to use this collection when it's all over, he and I talk about a lot of things about, well, if you were a researcher, how would you use this collection? Which is something I always think about anyway, but it's nice to have that other opinion.
Mm-hmm. Sarah? I can add to that. I've had a lot of great fortune with my graduate students because they do have a really high level of responsibility for decision making at Emory. And even though they sit at the desk right next to me and I am regularly available to ask them questions, I've been out of town for the last several days and they're kind of on their own, but I trust them and they have demonstrated quite a bit of talent. I have one PhD student in history. I have formerly had a PhD student in women's studies who was writing about beauty pageants in her dissertation, so she didn't have a lot of subject expertise. However, her grandparents were great friends with the Abernathys during the civil rights movement, so she actually knew a lot just having grown up in a family that had participated in a lot of the events that we have documentation for. Excuse me. So she was able to identify quite a number of photographs as well. And if we maybe saw a name that we didn't recognize, she on a couple of occasions called relatives to say, did you know this person? Who were they? What did they do? Our biggest challenge with using grad students sometimes actually is description. more than arrangement or being able to identify material, they sometimes are not entirely certain what the best way is to convey what is in that folder. So we have a lot of discussions about standards a little bit, but also getting them to step back and think about what the best way is to represent the material that they're dealing with.
And briefly, an example at Amistad, we had an interesting experience actually not that long ago. The papers of Ronnie Moore include images of civil rights demonstrations that were conducted by an organization called the Deacons for Defense and Justice, which was an armed civil rights organization. And there were some photographs of some of their demonstrations. We've actually been in touch with the son and daughter of the founder of the Bogalusa chapter, who they were able to come in and identify some of the photographs as well. So kind of taking that subject expertise, not necessarily from a student or a faculty member, but much like Sarah's saying, but from someone who knew the participants in those materials.
Okay. Ryan? Okay. The question was that through this collaboration, what have we learned from each other, and have we thought about learned from other institutions and then reapplied or rethought of what we're doing at our institutions?
We actually have, since the collaborative started at AUC, used forms created by Sarah for the SELC records for surveying large collections to do with some of our own. Not for VEP, for the project I'm working on, but in the department in general, we've taken the Emory forms as an example and massaged them as for collection survey purposes. So we've outright taken things already. we've also, within my own institution, one thing that we started using Archivist Toolkit specifically as a tool for our students, to directly interact with they're very adept at it, but we use it as a guide for our students to understand hierarchy and follow it along, and that's been really successful, and it's something we've shared and people go, oh really? Mm-hmm. So I think even with our own department, stuff that's come out of this project will get applied, but yeah, we've already taken openly from Emory on this.
Well, and I've also, and Sarah mentioned earlier, the work plans and things like that, that even though I'm at Auburn Avenue Research Library, I utilize those sources and apply them, which they haven't had these exact things before. So it's an experiment for them, too, to possibly, whether they use them in the future will not be my decision, but, you know, they'll have the record and be able to adapt it to what they need as well. Okay. In the gray back there? The question was whether or not we will continue our collaboration after our grant is over, which is in 2012. And we actually were just talking last night about, you know, and since we are in different geographical areas, we were talking about last night how after our grant is over, you know, trying to take what our collections are, topics, themes, and continuing to present about them maybe at scholarly conferences and other conferences. And, you know, we've mentioned, too, like, maybe a symposium someday, which, you know, some of the stuff we can't do until the collections are completely processed and available for researchers because we don't want them banging on our doors until we're ready. But so we have had those discussions already about how to continue in the future. And I think that, if I can speak for all of us, that we've all found these connections that, you know, we wouldn't have known existed unless we collaborated. You know, I think as archivists, we don't regularly go look at all kinds of other libraries to see, oh, what civil rights collections does this place have, And we all probably have something. So it's a start to try to open even that dialogue as to how can we continue to connect not just collections, but institutions. And I think we also wanted this to be, you know, we're the first to have this big collaboration in CLEAR and to show it as an example so other institutions can see, hey, it does work. I mean, you know, not everything does, as we've pointed out, but geography doesn't have to be a problem. So I don't know if anyone wants to add anything.
I think CLEAR has also made it clear that they are interested in seeing
collaboration mm-hmm. from more of their grantees. And I think one of our biggest challenges was really getting a white sheet of paper from them on how we were to collaborate. And really, it is, as Cheryl pointed out, it's problematic when you're still processing to sort of write papers for scholarly presentation just because you're still in the middle of the work. And so I'm hoping, even my grant actually ends in March, so I will be done well before the other institutions, but I'm a permanent staff member at AUC, so I can still contribute beyond that to the collaboration and whatever we do going forward.
In the back.
We decided
to collaborate because CLEAR told us to, essentially, because ARL and Auburn Avenue and Emory had submitted a grant together and then two other individual grants from Amistad and AUC, and they were all processing hidden civil rights collections, and so then CLEAR said, hey, we'll give you all this money if you collaborate together. So I don't, I mean, as far as I'm aware, there weren't any other institutions that were involved in that, but that's how it came about. So. Okay. The question was about travel and the fact that we haven't, that's not in our budgets to do and to travel, what we would meet about, and whether or not we can use Web 2.0 technology to use that. I think one of the things that would have been nice to do is to just meet each other and to talk. We all met Chris last night for the first time, even though we've all emailed and talked many times, but we had never met him before. So it would have been nice, and we've been working on this grant now for over a year. And so just actually physically all being together so we could talk about things. And like what some of the challenges we talked about were like establishing processes or guidelines, you know, perhaps the AT and Archon, like, guidelines, so that comparison of implementing that in the project, processing guidelines, you know, things like that. So essentially, I don't know if anyone.
Well, it's also a challenge for us to ever present together frequently about our hidden collections. And I think we're all looking at in, rather than the archives community presenting out to the scholarly community, especially about civil rights history, and at a certain point, it would be hard for the four of us to all appear together, so we kind of will in the future need to lean on each other for information about our collections to be able to cover that.
Yeah, and I think we've at least had open dialogue all along, so it's not like we're, you know, won't talk to each other or don't. It's just sometimes it's more fun to do it in person. Dan?
Did you ever get on the phone and have a conference call?
We do that at least once a quarter to have a conference call with all of us, as well as the people in charge of the project as well. So it's a larger group than just the four of us. But that's how we discuss, like, you know, that. And we do have email discussions back and forth when topics come up or, you know, blog things and stuff like that. So
I will say that it would have been really, really nice when we were putting that poster together if we could have had one representative from each project in the room while we were deciding on various design elements and actually working with the software and making last minute decisions. It's very difficult when you realize you have more white space on a 3 feet tall poster than you thought you would, to have to wait on an email from someone to tell you what you can put in that space. However, the conference calls and the emailing have been wonderful ways for us to discuss other things.
We haven't, the question was whether or not we use WebEx or any other technologies. Because we mostly just do discussions and have conversations, we haven't actually really talked about utilizing that source. It might have been helpful for the poster, but I don't know that we've had it as a requirement, but it's something we could think about if we do need to.
I don't know that Emory has anything like that. I know that our meeting room that would support the three Atlanta institutions actually being in the room together doesn't have computer technology in it. However, mostly we meet at Atlanta University Center, though, and I don't know what their mm-hmm. technological capabilities are.
Yeah, Auburn Avenue doesn't have anything like that either.
Yeah, we actually could support it at AUC. We just haven't, as a group, needed it.
Any other questions? Okay, the question and comment was that with SAA having the diversity statement in front and center right now, what are we doing to address that, to bring in other people? Courtney? You?
Oh, right. I'm sorry. Yeah, no, I have three students that work for me and have had others in the past. As they graduate, I lose them. But AUC is a consortium library for four HBCUs. So I am the minority on my staff, I guess. So I recruit, all my students come from Morehouse, Clark Atlanta, Spelman, or the Interdenominational Theological Center. So we actually at AUC Archives have had a great deal of luck of recruiting student workers to then come into the profession. A lot, like we were involved in the Mellon Library Recruitment Program, and I know we have had, like currently at Simmons, there are a few students that came out of AUC schools. And we bring in a lot of students to our library either through that program or just through our work-study program. I actually currently don't, this is the first time I have no students that are from history or African-American studies. We always like that, but I actually, one of my graduate students is a master's in public policy, environmental public policy specifically, and he has a background in biology. Shockingly, he's great at labeling things. I mean, he worked in a lab for 4 years as an undergraduate labeling water samples, and he can refolder like 20 feet in a day because he labeling speaks to him on a very personal level. And as far as diversity goes, I'm the new junior co-chair of the Archives and Archivists of Color Roundtable as of Tuesday. Cheryl asked me to bring that up. But my students are all from an HBCU environment. So we hope, we love to bring them into the profession, and I think my library specifically does a great job of it. I think one of our former students is in the room who just graduated library school and is an archivist at Boston University. So I think nationwide, Woodruff Library is a paragon of what SAA wants to see.
Did Amber work in the archives when she was at Spelman?
I don't know. But I love to brag about where I work, but we really make an effort.
Well, I just think that with this clear collaboration, it might be very interesting to emphasize, that this is another venue
At Amistad, in connection with our Embracing This Hidden Collections agenda, we've also, at about the same time, really began putting a focus on developing a more formalized intern and volunteer program at the center, with specifically looking to bring in students from underrepresented populations. In New Orleans, there are a number of HBCUs in New Orleans and in the area, and that's kind of gone hand in hand with working with these collections and bringing in additional student workers. Following Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, the center lost 70% of its staff, and so we have really focused on working on these collections with such a small staff in place, we've had to rely on bringing in additional help. And as I said, we've really worked with not only institutions like Xavier University, Dillard University, but also some of the local high schools to have students come in and introduce them to the archival profession. So,
yeah. Now, Auburn Avenue, too, not necessarily specific to the CLEAR grant, but one of my colleagues has started a very aggressive internship program where we get them from all over Atlanta. And being located on Auburn Avenue in, like, just down the street from the King Center, and we get some from the HCBUs and other local colleges, and so it's a wide variety of people that we've gotten in. But it looks like it's 9 o'clock. We'll all stick around if you have other questions, and thank you very much for coming.